Well, if burnout is a real possibility, and if it occurs more frequently than we like to think, let's look at some of the results of burnout. One of the results is you have an unmotivated leader. I mean, my goodness, who wants to be in that position where you're a leader but you're unmotivated? Or who wants to be in a position of laity and realize that you have a minister who is unmotivated? I mean, how can we be effective, and what can we offer to a church if we are inwardly suspecting that our work is futile, as the survey suggests that I relayed earlier? So how can we be effective, and how can we enthusiastically lead the church when inwardly, you know, we fight this increasing desire to escape our responsibilities? I think it's common sense that in order to inspire and motivate others, that it's helpful if our own inspiration motivation is doing well. Another thing with individuals who are experiencing burnout is they tend to be frequent movers, and they move from one ministry to the next. And I'm not suggesting that everyone who moves is facing burnout. I'm not suggesting that at all. I think the average stay in the Protestant church in America is only 2.3 years, which is not very long at all. So I think we have a problem with tenure for various reasons. But one of them obviously has to do with burnout. I mean, my goodness, can you imagine going someplace? I've been there. I've done that, where you're so excited. You're ready to spend the next 20 years of your life. Things happen. Events come. And you're so demotivated. And you're so burnt out after spending so much time and so much energy that, you know, the thing that we think we should do is to pack up and leave and go to another church, because that motivates us for another 2 years, another 3 years. Now, there's a great deal more that we could say about burnout, but I wanted to bring the concept to your attention, because I think it's impossible. It's entirely possible that you may be experiencing some burnout. And to understand this, and if you are experiencing some of that, to begin to seek some assistance in dealing with that. You know, there are some of people who feel that as Christians we should never burn out, we should never experience this, and many of them would blast away at us for even mentioning the term burnout. Christian burnout is an oxymoron, they would say. But I don't think that's the case. I think it's entirely possible to experience burnout, just as you do in any other field or profession, just as it's an option there as well. But one of the things that you can do is to learn about stress management. Boy, you know, music is powerful. When I was in the pastorate, I would put some headphones on, put some music, and for a half hour, I'd lay on the floor with the door shut, with the headphones on, just relaxing. You know, you need to get rest. You need to exercise. You need to have some meaningful recreation. Those things are important. And sometimes the pastor's day off, you know, is the worst day off. Some people take Monday off because they're so exhausted that they need to, but then, you know, then they take a whole day to recuperate when maybe they should consider taking another day when they feel better. But one of the things that we can do is to learn some stress management principles. Another thing that will provide stress for a minister is an individual or individuals who cling to the minister like vines. They are individuals who are just zap and sap your energy right out of you. They have that ability because of who they are, their nature, their personality. They just drain you. And so one of the things, if you're a lay person, is to create ways that you can protect your pastor from that. You know, you may want to get a secretary who makes appointments, who screens calls. You may want to get a group of individuals who handle the counseling load in the church. These sort of things. Be creative. One of the things that I encourage pastors to do, and I've faced a lot of criticism with regard to this, but one of the ways that you can avoid burnout or delay it is to focus on your strengths and your giftedness. I understand that in ministry that we have to be functioning at various levels. If all we ever did was those things we like to do or those things that we were good at, life would be easy. We do have to do those things that we're not very good at or that we don't like to do. And sometimes that teaches us and it makes us better. But by the same token, God gave gifts to the church, and it's my understanding that he gave those gifts for the benefit of the church. And so if I begin to function in areas where I'm not gifted, I am in reality hurting the church because I'm not being used to my full potential, am I? It's not to say that just because my gift isn't in evangelism that I never evangelize. I'm not saying that. I'm saying to begin to focus more and go with your strengths because it'll be a natural for you, and it's what God intended you to do. And so if you're a lay individual here, you can begin to acknowledge your minister's strengths and tell the minister how much you appreciate their strengths and give them time to function in that area. Another thing that pastors can do to avoid burnout is to find some sort of support group. Sometimes that takes the form of other pastors. Sometimes that's not a safe support group, depending upon the town, the community you live in. I was involved in one that it was never a support group for me. It was work because one of the pastors lived, 15 minutes away, who happened to be the son of one of my elders. And he could never share anything because it was always get back to Dad, who was on the board, and Dad was often antagonistic. And so it was much more of a chore for me, and it wasn't a real safe place for me to share and to be with. But gathering with people who love you, who like you, is energizing. And I think if you can surround yourself with those kind of people at conferences, at seminars, or just a handful of church, and that's not to say that we exclude everybody else. It's just a smaller group of individuals that can help you and encourage you. Let me talk very briefly now about professional isolation. You know, I'm amazed at the number of individuals who do not understand, nor do they appreciate, the unique environment of the church. Many individuals that I have worked with and many whom I've pastored have felt like it's just another job. It's just like what they do when they go to work. And you know, there are some very good similarities, and certainly we both work, we have jobs to do, but there are so many differences that make the church unique that I think it would be very helpful for you to consider that, and for lay people to reconsider that. One of the things that pastors often have is you know, this whole aspect of calling. Because, you know, let's face it, even though that our identity comes from Christ, we live in an environment where if you ask people to identify themselves, they'll give you a name, and then they identify the occupation that they are holding. We somehow tend to attribute worth from our job. We get our identity from our job. Whether that's right or wrong, I don't want to get into it at this particular juncture, but I do want to say that we have a tendency to do that. So how does a minister, as a professional, and I don't mean that in a negative term, I just mean as though that's the job, how does a minister measure success when ministry is isolated from others? Other fields, it's different. So the pastorate is a unique calling. It's a unique field, and if you want to call it a career choice, it's very unique. If you want to call it a calling from the Lord, it's very unique as well. Most people understand that they are called into ministry, and it's much more noticeable than if I were called to IBM. It's different, first of all, because it is highly subjective. Now, the New Testament says very little about the calling of God to the gospel ministry. There is a call that comes through, or at least is accompanied by, the recognition of church leaders. the Bible does talk about spiritual maturity and having the right gifts, and one's own desire to serve in the capacity is important as well. So a person's desire to enter ministry can be confirmed or denied by the presence or absence of observable qualities. And by the same token, encouragement from others to consider ministry can be weighed against a person's own spirit-led desire. So there was a balance, I think, in the early church, but I think today sometimes we can get out of balance. We can emphasize the calling without necessarily taking an objective look at a person's talents and abilities. By the same token, we can focus on someone's talents and abilities without the subjective aspect of calling from the Lord. So in other words, we wouldn't push people into being a dentist if they didn't really want to be a dentist, even though they had the skills to be a dentist. I remember my father wanted me to be an optometrist, and I really didn't want to be one. And so and he didn't really push me in that direction, but if he had, I would have been an unhappy camper with regard to that decision. By the same token, we don't want individuals who have a desire to be a dentist, who have shaky hands and couldn't hold the instruments right, we wouldn't want to push them into ministry either. So in other words, there's a balance that's necessary. And so this professional isolationism is one aspect of why individuals are leaving the church. And being a minister means that you have high and lofty expectations. You have a holy calling. So you see, we do have a unique environment because of this calling and sometimes the subjectiveness of it. And we also have these unique expectations. Edward Bratcher, in his book, The Walk on Water Syndrome, says that pastors are asked to walk on water. I mean, lay people would never say that, but we do kind of expect that. And instead of being a mortal who's trying to live for Christ, it's almost as if they expect the minister to be in a Messiah apprenticeship. And so this isolationism comes largely because of these unrealistic expectations. In one survey, 47% indicated that unwritten congregational expectations contributed to their decision to resign. Another area of uniqueness with regard to isolationism is that we have a unique leadership. I mean, a pastor must lead, but the pastor's not the boss. And a pastor must be responsible for what happens, but a pastor has no authority beyond the pastor's ability to persuade. And so we have to manage differently. We as ministers can't say, in practical terms, you know, here's the plan, let's do it. We have to manage differently. We have to influence people. We have to be much more subtle. Even though we're hired to lead, the congregation is not always in the mood to follow. And so not only do we have a unique issue of leadership, but we also have a followership issue as well. But I simply say that because it means that the pastor cannot manage the same way that other organizations do. We also in ministry have a unique accountability. And in business world, you know, workers are always accountable to someone. And the CEO of the company has the greatest accountability of all. They have to answer to the board, the stockholders, and ultimately the customers. And in most instances, if we're lucky, the CEO is fortunate because the board will clearly define how it will supervise and evaluate his or her performance. But the pastorate is not so fortunate. We have clear accountability. But the biblical accountability can be compromised by our willingness or our desire or temptation to please people. So the average church expects a pastor to be accountable to two groups of people. He's accountable to the church board, and the pastor is accountable to the church body at large. Not only do we have these two accountability areas, but this accountability also has to do with his professional life as a minister, and also the minister's private affairs with regard to the family. So it's very unique there as well. And so oftentimes you will have the even if you did have written expectations from the minister, they may not be the real expectations from the power body within the church or the congregation at large. You also have differences within the congregation. I mean, you have older individuals who maybe want a country pastor, spends a lot of time visiting. Maybe some of the younger families want a competent manager, someone who can get the show on the road and make things happen. Finally, with regard to professional isolationism, ministers have a unique salary structure, at least they do in the United States. You know, if you've ever candidated for a church and when it comes time to discuss salary and the board says, well, how much do you need? That ought to give you some indication of their view of money and their view of the value that you hold for them. And oftentimes this whole idea of pastor salary raises gets stuck at the end of a long board meeting. It's not really given the time that it needs. There's no objective standard for that. Many times people compare the pastor's salary to their own. And they don't realize sometimes that what's listed in the church budget represents more than the actual paycheck. So many of our pastors are lacking of material compensation. Now, I'm not saying that they should get rich, but I do believe that a workman is worthy of his hire. And I think it's biblical to pay appropriately. And there's this whole issue with regard to finances. And if you don't pay your pastor well, you're in essence saying we don't value you. And then you have the whole issue of, with the breakdown, you have the parsonage, which, the pastor can live in a parsonage if you have one. There's certain tax benefits to that, but there's no equity being built up for him or her. Sometimes professional meetings, professional books and journals and such are taken as part of a pastor's salary when in actuality they are professional expenses and such. So what I'm saying is it's an issue that you need to be aware of, not only the burnout, but also this whole idea of the uniqueness of ministry. And if you've been in ministry very long, you understand exactly what I'm talking about. The question is, how are you dealing with it? How are you processing this? One of the things that we can do is to begin to educate our laity, church boards and such, with an understanding of a pastor's job and a pastor's salary. I think it's detrimental to begin to compare salaries. I'm not sure that salaries are comparable. For instance, oftentimes in the States, a minister's salary is likened to a teacher, because that's what a minister does, is teach. But by the same token, that's inadequate as well, because teachers in America teach for 9 months. They have 3 months off, and they often have holidays off. It's just different, and it would be inappropriate to say that. So there has to be some objectivity to it. I think that as lay people, we can affirm the value of our pastor's work. I mean, we tend to think that pastors are beyond a need for self-esteem or affirmation. There was one book I read that basically, or one survey that I read that said the most basic need that keeps coming up over and over again from pastors in the ministry is they are in need of affirmation. Now, you might say, well, my goodness, how can you be a Christian? You're supposed to receive your affirmation from God. And that's true. I understand that. But in the real world, where the rubber meets the road, isn't it nice to have someone say, you did well. You did well. I appreciate that. That was nice. I mean, we don't live for those things. Believe me. I don't live for those things. And when I was pastoring and shook hands at the end of the service, at the end of the day, I didn't put much stock into good sermon really meant a lot to me, or the criticisms that were given at those particular times. I didn't pay much stock in that. But there were times when it meant immense, when it was of immense value to me when someone says, Pastor, and I know this was a difficult thing to go through with this particular family, and I know it demanded a lot of time and a lot of energy and emotional energy, and I just want you to know that I think you did a nice job with that, and I want to tell you I appreciate that. Boy, wow, that'll go a long way. Affirm the value of your pastor's work. A lot of churches have a pastor parish committee in which mediates and is a liaison between the pastor and the congregation. But I think it might be nice just to have a pastoral support team, people who have a passion for their minister, people who have a love for their pastor, who understand this unique situation, this professional isolationism, the high expectations and such, and will just uphold them in prayer. I know that you know some people like that in your congregation. Maybe you could talk about a pastoral support team. Now, I want to turn my attention very quickly to inadequate education. Do you realize that in America, the average pastor has more education than pastors in any other generation in American history? I mean, we have a good number of pastors who hold master's degrees, yet many of them feel inadequately trained for ministry. I remember with a couple of my courses and some of the seminars that I've given, I've had students come up to me many times and say, boy, if I just would have known this earlier. You know, they never taught us how to handle conflict in the church when I was in seminary. Boy, they never taught us anything about spiritual warfare. I have missionaries who are overseas who say, my goodness, I learned a lot about church history, but what I really need is how to overcome the evil one while I'm in Brazil. Now, don't get me wrong, there's a good solid place for a good solid understanding of church history and theology and all of that. I am all in favor of that. But sometimes education and real world get misaligned. Let me give you one example that I think of. In most seminaries, and I'm talking about graduate schools that train individuals for ministry, and I'm generalizing here. I know there are exceptions, but this is my opinion. You may disagree. I think there's a tendency, at least in the States anyway, to create CEOs. We're sending out ministers who are chief executive officers. They're ready to take over the company and run the ship. Now, combine that with the, or try to align that with the real world. The real world says that the average church in America is about 110 people, average attendance, and they're highly familial. In other words, there's a high degree of cultural context there. Families are related to one another. Mom and dad been there for years, and grandpa's been there even longer, and mom married so-and-so's daughter, and it goes on. And they're highly relational. And so I wonder if that model of education aligns well with where the church is. Let me give you another typical illustration here. I think sometimes the church and the seminaries view things differently. Now, in a typical seminary, a traditional seminary, I suppose that they might see an emphasis, first of all, on languages, the Greek and Hebrew. Then they would follow that by an emphasis on theology and maybe biblical exposition. And then maybe a practicum. In other words, the practical, the real life ministry situations. But, you know, it's interesting that churches see things in just the reverse of that. When you look at the church ministry, most of the time, most of the church's time and the minister's time is not consumed with languages or theology or biblical exposition, although that takes place on Sundays. Most of the time takes place in practical matters. So the practicum would come first, followed by biblical exposition and then theology, and languages would come in a distant last. So what I'm saying is that there's this misalignment between education and real world of ministry. So what I'm saying is it quite possible that in our training and our understanding of ministry that we have been inadequately trained? We've been trained in theology, but we're sorely lacking in practical skills. And I think we need a balance of the two. I mean, obviously your practice is grounded in your theology, and one without the other is useless, but it's the emphasis of education that somehow is misaligned. not only do we have this inadequacy of education, and but we also have, in certain circles, almost a distrust of the education. Because churches are getting pastors who are inadequately trained, they therefore mistrust the educational process. And, you know, 2 Peter says that we are to add to our faith knowledge, and it has a whole list of other things. So we're supposed to grow and learn in our faith and our understanding. In many ways, education is seen as the devil's work, which is just sad in light of 2 Peter. Because the whole picture of a Christian in the New Testament is one who's living, who's growing in the Lord, who's maturing. Not someone who's perfect, but someone who's ever growing. One of the things that I encourage you to do is to always have a learning attitude. And then we get pastors who come out of a seminary with high educational bills, and they serve a church that doesn't pay very much. So again, the circle continues where we're adding to frustration and stress. You know, we're living in a world where education is more and more important. Just because you have a degree doesn't mean you're anointed of God. Just because you have a degree doesn't mean that you're any better off than anybody else. But learning is a biblical thing. And I think churches should begin to look at that and value that. There's a price to pay for that. Your pastor's going to need time off, going to need to take some training. But, you know, if you just corner your pastor and say, you can never get out of here, no, you can't do this, we don't have money for you to have a book amount or journal articles or such, you're going to end up hurting yourself. Education is more than an expense on a line item budget. It's an investment, one that will return to the church through the efforts of a better equipped pastor. Another thing that you can do is start an internship program for theological students in your areas. Call up the seminaries and say, hey, we'd love to have someone here and, you know, have an internship here. You can also begin your own institute of, you know, biblical institutes in your church for your community. And we all understand that we don't know everything in life when we're 23 or 24 or 26, whenever we graduate from seminary. So if you're a layperson, give your pastor time to grow. And some things they will have to learn through the hard way, but that's the way life is. This is the end of number one.